Bashir, at 4 o'clock, we'll hear a National Press Club address with General William Westmoreland. Westmoreland recently dropped his controversial libel suit against CBS Television. He sued in response to the CBS documentary, The Uncounted Enemy, which made the case that Westmoreland falsified reports on the number of communist troops in Vietnam. At the National Press Club today, Westmoreland discussed his reasons for filing the suits, his reason for dropping the charges, and he also talked about how the press covers public officials. It had been announced that filmmaker John Sayles would be with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. John Sayles will be with us for a live Fresh Air interview this coming Tuesday at 3:45. And time permitting today, we'll hear a reading that he recently did of one of his short stories. But John Sayles will be with us for the live interview this Tuesday at 3:45. With me now on Fresh Air is writer Alex Haley. Haley's family genealogy, as told in his book Roots, awakened a national interest in tracing family history. Haley followed his maternal family history back 200 years and six generations to Kunta Kinte, a youth who was abducted from his home in West Africa and taken in shackles on a slave ship to America. Roots became the best-selling book in publishing history and won a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. The television miniseries Roots drew the largest audience in TV history when it was first broadcast in 1977. Haley's first book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, published in 1965, was based on a year of interviewing and traveling with Malcolm X. It remains one of the essential books of modern Black American thought and politics. Alex Haley's forthcoming book is about his childhood in Henning, Tennessee. The book is scheduled for publication in September. It's called Henning. It wasn't until he retired from a 20-year career from the Coast Guard that Alex Haley began submitting his writing for publication. Alex Haley is in Philadelphia to speak tonight at a benefit for the Philadelphia Miniversity, which is a community-based educational program. For more information on his talk this evening, you can call the Miniversity at 765-2815. That's 765-2815. Alex Haley, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Well, I'm glad to be on Fresh Air, Terry.
Were you interested in your family history at all before you started to actually research it for Ruth?
Not in the sense of anything like trying to write it. I was interested in it because I really, as a little boy, grew up very much under the influence of my maternal grandmother, who somehow or other just loved to talk about the family's history. She and her sisters in the summers used to come together. The sisters would come to visit. And they just would every evening sit on the front porch and talk about their parents, about their father's father, who was named Chicken George, about his mother, who was called Miss Kizzy, about her father, who was called the African, who said his name was Kinte, and so forth. And I, little boy, heard it repetitively, and thus I learned it, much the same as I learned the biblical parables in Sunday school during the same period of time. And I reacted to those stories, I guess, about the same way I reacted to the story of David and Goliath or whatever. And I didn't realize it, and certainly they didn't, that we were really on the front porch there at Grandma's the summer evenings, involving in the oldest form of human communication of intelligence and information, oral history, from the memories through the mouths of the elders to the ears of the younger. And I grew up, you know, with the story fairly well entrenched, again, like the biblical parables that you remember all your life after having learned them when you were a child. And then it just happened that after I became a writer by chance and had written my first book, I got curious about the stories I'd heard and began researching.
I think that a lot of children resist their family history or their family folklore because for some children they find it almost inhibiting. Did you ever go through a period like that of not wanting to hear the family stories anymore?
No, I didn't, but I tell you who sure did, and I often think about it. If I had to get the story in a generational pattern from my grandmother to my mother to me, I would never have heard it. Because my mother, who was the first generation of the family ever to go to college, thought it was baneful. The only time I can ever remember my mother and grandmother having an argument was about that very issue. My mother would say, "Oh, Ma, why don't you quit talking that old slavery stuff?" It embarrassed my mother very much. And she was really upset with my grandmother, who would get equally upset with her and say, well, if you don't care where you come from, I do. And the two of them would get very taut about it. And it has an analogy in the European derivation people, or what we colloquially call white people, in the sense of the immigrants. The families which actually immigrated from Europe, almost always the pattern was that the elders who had come over, when they got here, tried in every way they could to keep alive the old country ways and customs and stories. And the younger members of the family were so excited about becoming that new, dramatic, exciting thing called the becoming American that they sloughed off and ignored and even looked down upon the old country customs and ways. And in that way, many, many families of a European background lost critical information that generations now, 10, 12 generations later, would give anything to know. You know, what was the village the family lived in? Who were the members of families? Many of these things got lost completely because the young were not interested in, and indeed rejected at that time, the information which would have been so easily available from the parent sitting right there.
You know, it's interesting. I know that for a lot of people whose grandparents were from Europe, they didn't want to talk about the past.
That's
right. It was the old country, and not only didn't the new generation want to hear about it, but the generation that had come from Europe, or especially Eastern Europe, didn't want to talk about it, because I don't know why. Maybe because it had bad memories, or maybe because it had good memories.
Well, it oftentimes was because it had some memory of some nature that they did not feel, as you say, comfortable talking about it. You know, it's like in, to some degree, the reasons are the same no matter what the ethnic group is or the cultural group is. But then sometimes there are specific things. Now, I know that particularly, say, in black genealogy, one of the things that people so often run into when they're talking to elders is the elder may talk fairly freely about this or that or the other, and then all of a sudden, when pursuing some avenue of the family, will just clam up. And what you can almost always guarantee was some incident of what we call infidelity, if you use that fancy word, but to them at that time was very, very shameful. People looked upon that as a smudge on the family if a young woman had a child out of wedlock or something. Now the society does not view it that way, but at that time they did. And the elders now grew up in that time, and they still feel it to be a smudge on the family, so they won't talk about it.
Mm. You were mentioning that your mother really didn't want to have much of a part of the family history and the passing on of the family history. How did she feel about you researching roots?
Oh, my mother was long since passed away.
Oh, was she?
And, yeah, she passed away when I was 10. So she didn't, you know, was never even remotely aware that I was ever going to be a writer. In fact, my mother only hoped that I would get some better grades in the time when she was living. My grandmother, neither did she know. She passed away in 1948 before I began to talk about roots at all. And so none of them really were very, very, they just didn't know. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever wonder what it would be like if, after having done all the research into your family past, you found out that your family was, say, very mediocre, or that within your family past there were people who you didn't much like, who had done things that you didn't respect? Because I think that's happened to some people, that
sure
that
is.
Instead of finding wonderful and glorious past, they found, or you know, inspirational past, that they found things that they were really uncomfortable with.
Yeah, well, you know, almost a cliche among genealogically oriented people is that somebody found that an ancestor was a horse thief. That's an old thing. Well, from a strictly genealogical point of view, you're lucky, if so, and the reason is that there were records of horse thieves. Your difficulty is finding records of people. And, you know, this thing of which you speak, I really, I don't think that I would feel shame if an ancestor did something negative It would depend on what they did. I mean, I wouldn't be too proud of, say, a murderer or something like that. But at the same time, it's an abstract thing. You know, somebody who was your great or great-great-grandparent, they lived back in another time, another era, and other circumstances. And see, this is something that not only genealogical, but people who are involved in history and historical research encounter lots of times. And I tend to deal in history, so I'm very familiar with it, that when you are researching something that happened a way back, you need to keep in mind, firmly in mind, that that was then, and certain things existed at that time, culturally, socially, which do not exist today. And you must always try to cast in your mind what was the social circumstance under which those people lived, so that you might find very well in, say, the time of the opening of the West, you know, it was man for man. It was the survival of the fittest. So murder might have been much more understandable then than it is today. If it was a question of you are going to kill somebody, they'd kill you. I would not want to live in such a time, but that was the way it was at that particular time, in that particular place, and lots of other places.
I'm speaking with Alex Haley. When you went to Africa, you were in a way going home, but on the other hand, you were going to a foreign country that you didn't grow up in and that you'd never been in before. Which sensation did you feel more of, the feeling of going home or the feeling of being in a foreign place?
You know, interestingly enough, Terry, it was kind of a mix of the two. The sense of going home was kind of an intellectual, theoretical sense. You know, I knew that that was home. Africa really was in some, to some degree, home for virtually all black people, as we label ourselves now. And yet, because I had been born and bred in this country, I had to feel that I was going to a land abroad, a land that was indeed, in lots of respects, foreign. And when I got there, I think that probably the most emotional thing was the internal mix and trauma of these two things. You know, let me tell you some of these just little examples. For instance, I remember that in Africa, periodically I would see a man. It was more frequently men than women. And I would think, wow, he looks just like my barber. Or he looks like so-and-so whom I know such-and-such place. And it just began to hit me how many similar facial, or physiognomy, I think is the word they call that, or facial features. And then conversely, I began to hear Africans who would see black Americans, and there were a few around, say like in Dakar, Senegal, and whatnot, and they would look at black Americans, Africans. Let me back up. I was with Africans. We would maybe be in a restaurant or somewhere, and they would see other black Americans walking along. And sometimes the Africans would say, he looks like a Wolof. Wolof is a tribe. Or he looks like a Mandinka. Or that person looks like a Fulani. And I begin to realize the interaction, even after the generations, even after the decades, succession of decades, centuries, in fact, there remain these features, which people grounded in one or the other saw in the other. I remember a thing that was very, very moving, upsetting to me, really, was when I was on my way up the river to the little village where ultimately I found Kunta Kinte had come from. I had chartered a little vessel called the it escapes me, it'll come to me, the name of the little boat. It was not all that long, and there were 14 of us on this boat, a little cabin cruiser, the Badibou, that was the name of it, B-A-D-D-I-B-U. And on the way up the river, as we were putting along, I kept thinking something was bothering me, and I couldn't put my finger on what was it. And I suppose we were, I don't know, a few miles up to, when suddenly it hit me that I was the only one my complexion on the boat. Now, I might be described, I suppose, as brown, but everybody else on that boat was black as tar. And I had the most incredible sensation of being hybrid, of being impure among the pure, and of being alien. And I began to almost feel, I hope none of them would notice or something. And I don't think, as far as I know, any of them did notice. But I did, and it was just, it just bothered me. Now, later on, I didn't feel that at all, but at that particular time, I did. And what I was experiencing was merely another facet of the cultural mix and the cultural factors that you do deal with in situations like that, or when I got in the village. The way that once the people saw me and understood through the interpreters where I was from, and then I tell you, another very emotional thing was the old man, not they don't call him chief, they call him, in that particular place, they call him the Alcala, it's A-L-C-A-L-A of the village. He kind of pondered what they had told him, that I was from this country. And then he spoke to the interpreters in Mandinka, and all the people, of course, were listening as he spoke, the people of the village. And then the interpreter turned to me and translated. And he said, I had learned earlier, I was the first black American they had ever seen in that little village. And the interpreter translated what the chief had said, and it was essentially something like, yes, we have been told by the forefathers that there are many of us from this place who are in exile in that place called America and in other places, unquote. And that hit me emotionally because I realized then they were not seeing me as individual. Alex Haley, writer, they didn't know any more about him or care any more about him than the man in the moon. But what they saw me as was a symbol of all those black American people they had heard about. And that was very moving. And I think that was probably the pivot around which my perspective of the book that I was going to try and write, I had not then begun writing at all, changed. Up to that time, I had really kind of been thinking about writing a book about my family in its past. And with that perspective from this Alcala, I began to perceive that what I was really writing was a book which would take my family as its structural point, but which really would be about a kind of a symbol book about a people, the black people in this country, because all of us, more or less, share the same story that Roots would tell. Virtually all black people, you take it back, have in the background some Kunta Kinte, or female counterpart. They were taken in Africa. Somehow, they were put into some one of those many, many slave ships which crossed the same oceans, ocean singular. Usually the voyages average 2 months to 2.5 months, coming either to this country or to the Caribbean. And then they were on some plantation, or plantations plural as the years went on up to the Civil War, the emancipation of the Civil War, and then struggle for freedom from that day to this day. And so the book Roots really became a kind of symbolic book of a people.
I think for some people, when they become aware of their past or their family's past in another country, that they start borrowing things from that country and integrating it into their own life, even things like clothes. And surely a lot of people have, in America, started dressing in more African clothing as a kind of symbolic assertion of their connection to Africa. Did you ever do that or go through a period like that of just wanting objects or clothing or adornments, art from Africa in your home or on your body?
No, I personally didn't go very much into it. I didn't go so much into the clothing thing at all. But, I mean, I was given, you know, I have a fair little collection of African garments I've been given by different ones. In some cases, I've bought them. But I hardly ever wear them as such. I have more what might be called artifacts, objects, carvings, things like that, which again I've bought some of here and some there. I had bought a beautiful statue, an African. It really isn't historical. It's just a lovely modern carving of an African woman, and I bought it in Paris about 6 months ago, I guess, and paid too much for it. But it's lovely. And I know what you mean, but I did not myself do that too much. I suppose one of the reasons is that, you know, I'm older. That tended to be younger people who would do that. I fancy I have seen more. I've watched more cycles, you know, unfold. As a writer, I kind of tend to see myself as an observer more than so much as a participant. You know, it's like sometimes people will say, did you get excited when this happened? And you know what I do, and I've heard other writers say the same thing, is that when something is going on, you might be in the midst of a melee of activity. But as a writer, you tend to back away from it, and you're observing, recording as much as you possibly can, every piece of minutiae about it that you can. And it's afterwards, when it's all over, that then you get scared, that you might have been wiped out right there when that was going on, you know.
I'm speaking with Alex Haley. Since your personal story has become a story that the whole nation knows now, because nearly everyone has either read the book or seen the TV miniseries or both, how has the kind of popularization of that story affected your own extended family's grasp of their personal history? In other words, are those stories still getting passed on now that they've been told in the mass media in your family? Is your family passing on those stories in a way different from the way they were?
Not in the same manner. No, they're not. And the reason is, I suppose among the reasons are that the book exists. You see, the purpose of the passing on of stories, you know, among families has been simply to see that they are perpetuated. And in this case, now there is the book Roots, which my family would pretty much relate to. And an example, we had a pretty big family reunion. And it was very interesting to note that the people who had drawn up graphs of family, you know, the genealogical graphs, would refer to always start with Kunta Kinte. And then they'd come down, and the thing would be back, say, in the period of just an antebellum period, when it had been somebody had X number of siblings. Then you'd see the people's graphs would come off from this sibling or that sibling. Say the Chicken George had six children. And that's where you'd see people branching off his siblings. That was Tom. My immediate ancestor was Tom, one of his six children. Well, there were the other five, and you'd see people branching off them and so forth. Or my grandmother had seven sisters. Yeah, there were altogether eight. There were no boys in that particular family, all girls. And then you'd see people who branched off those sisters who were my great aunts. So that's about what it is. And they all accepted the same body story. But the drama now was what happened since the book. You know, watching the children and see what they're doing, the great-grandchildren. And it's really kind of exciting to see the really dramatic things that many of the children are doing by comparison with what the book talked about and the circumstances under which the people lived in the book.
You're writing now about Henning, Tennessee, which is the place that you grew up in, and you've turned from genealogy to your own childhood. Mm-hmm. What kind of place was Henning, Tennessee?
I chuckle because when Henning, Tennessee was and is, I might further add, the kind of place that people driving through probably think, wow, what a dusty little nowhere dump. It's a little town, population 550, when I was there, and I understand it's now 480, which is hardly a town. It's a hamlet almost. It's in the western part of the state of Tennessee, 50 miles from Memphis, north of Memphis. It's on U.S. 51, which in my time as a child, it was called the old Jefferson Davis, or Jeff Davis Highway. Little farming town. Very, very little is happening there. It's waning now in the sense that it's one, again, of those many, many little towns where the young who have any talent at all going or aspirations going, they leave home and they don't come back because there's not much in Henning to draw them back. Now, at the time I was there, the town was much more vital, although small. It was the kind of town where, although people would think nothing can be happening there, the truth is for us who live there, it was a buzz with activity. Nobody passing through would begin to know the amount of gossip that was just radiating from one place to another, who was doing what, this, that, the other. And what I write about is not so much me in the town at the time, but I write with nostalgia about people who were the personalities in the town and about things which occurred within the town. Lovely little stories which are really Americana, because when you write of one town, you write in a sense of all small towns. Small towns share some qualities such as that, whereas in cities, you have to, let's say a Philadelphia, you have to do something pretty spectacular not to be anonymous in Philadelphia. You know, you have to be a Terry sitting here with a microphone. People call your name and people know you. But there are 50,000 people whose names could be called and only their friends would know who they were. In Henning, that wouldn't have to be. In Henning, people stood out for much lesser reasons. You could stand on the corner and people would go by and say, he's the strongest man in town. Or that lady makes the best peach pie in this town. Or that person over there does such and such. That person can pick more cotton than anybody else. And things like that. And then there were funny little things. Like,
what were you known for?
What was I known? I wasn't big enough to... You know, yes, I can tell you what I was known. I was Miss Sis Palmer's grandboy. And that's what I was. And that put me in good condition because Miss Sis Palmer was a force in town. Miss Sis Palmer, my grandma, was in everybody's business. She was a major person in the church. She was known as one of the better cooks. And I don't know why that was, but somehow my grandma had a particular reputation for cooking black-eyed peas in some way that was, I guess, somehow different. But people always talk about Miss Sis's black-eyed peas, things like that. And I grew on up under the mantle of my grandmother with great, great pride. She was a marvelous lady.
Mm. Never bothered you that you were known as the grandson of?
Bothered me. I was proud to be her grandson. It wasn't grandson. Nobody ever said that. She said grandboy. There's a big difference between being a grandson and a grandboy, you know, and I'm talking about purely in the idiom sense. But in these towns, there were things like, say, we had a lady named Sister Will Ada Curry, who was our town's Associated Press. She could spread news faster than the speed of light. And every little town, if you said that, could tell you who was there, Sister Will Ada Curry. We had a man, I have a piece in next month's, the April issue of the Reader's Digest, a condensation of a piece from this book, is about a minister who lived in our town. His name was Reverend Douglas. And he became a legend within the town. And one of my thrills now as a writer is to be able to reach back in the nostalgia of our little town and draw up some people and paint them and have them written about or have them published in magazines that go worldwide so that Reverend Douglas will now preach to the world in a sense, when otherwise nobody would ever have heard again of Reverend Douglas.
You said a lot of people driving past Henning, Tennessee, would assume it's the kind of place or that it was the kind of place where everyone growing up there had it as one of their goals to leave and to move somewhere else.
Not at that time. Uh-huh. No, I'm saying now.
Now it would be that way. Why did you leave it?
Well, I left because my dad and mother, my dad was a professor, mm-hmm. and, you know, we would sort of go where he was teaching. And then we'd come back in the summers. I'm talking about we children. I have two brothers, George and Julius. I'm the oldest of us. George is a lawyer next to me, and Julius is an architect, the youngest of us. And we would come back there in the summer, and we would look to our grandmother like an oasis. She was just our source of strength. And she was a storyteller. She was a great cook. She loved us in a way that grandparents only can love you. You know, I have a thing about my grandmother, such an influence on me. I really kind of have grown up into now a grown man, sort of with a sensation that if somebody tells me anybody, and it's that I'm not talking about black, I'm talking about anybody I see, and somebody says she's somebody's grandmother, I just have the impulse to go hug the lady, because that's the way I feel about grandparents. I think, love your mama, love your daddy, and you ought to. They brought you in the world and they do all these things, but nobody in the world can do for little children quite what grandparents do. Grandparents kind of sprinkle stardust into the lives of little children. And I really, really, truly feel, Terry, that one of the things our society now, with all our technology and our super mobility and all these magical wonders and our instant gratifications, I think one thing we are losing so much that's so sad is that fewer and fewer little children are being directly exposed to grandparents than used to be the case. Because grandparents round off the edges of children in ways that just parents are too busy to do.
Are you a grandparent?
Oh, sure, I'm a grandparent. Mm-hmm.
And were you able to be in the same city as your grandchildren are?
No, I'm not. And I'm not, you know, funny, ironically, I would fall in that category of the people who believe devoutly something and who talk it, but the nature of what I do keeps me from doing what I'm talking about. Grandchildren would keep up with me very much is be on planes all, you know, much of the time. That's just the way my life goes. However, I do devoutly believe in what I'm talking about grandparents. And, you know, there really is, there's an affinity between grandparents and grandchildren. It's very curious. Like people involved in genealogy, family searching, will tell you that for some reason, when it comes to interviewing elders for information about the family, for some reason, grandparents will tell their grandchildren more than they'll tell their children. And somebody made a joke, said, you know, the reason that there's such an affinity between grandparents and grandchildren is that they share a common enemy. You know, it's something to think about. Yeah.
My guest is Alex Haley, if you're just joining us. And by the way, his new book, Henning, which is about growing up in Henning, Tennessee, will be published in September. And he's here in Philadelphia to speak this evening at a benefit for the Philadelphia Miniversity. The first book that you wrote, the autobiography of Malcolm X, like Roots, was an incredibly influential book. And I think it was a very important book to a lot of people. How did you get to write that book with Malcolm X? I imagine after you had the idea, the first thing you had to do was get his cooperation.
No, it didn't work that way at all. I mean, it would seem it went that way. No, what happened was I had been 20 years in the U.S. Coast Guard. That's where I learned to write as a sailor. And when I came out, the first magazine assignment I received was from the Reader's Digest to do an article about the then exciting new organization colloquially called the Black Muslims, which properly is called the Nation of Islam. And the spokesman at the time was Malcolm X. And so I went, you know, and asked permission to talk with him, which he granted and everything. And then I talked with him in Harlem, and then he said that he wouldn't really get into any detail with me unless I got the approval of his leader, who was Mr. Elijah Muhammad, who lived in Chicago. And Malcolm arranged that I could talk with him, and I went to Chicago and talked with Mr. Muhammad, who gave permission that Malcolm could talk with me. Then I came back, and Malcolm and I spent, 2-3 weeks together, This was for a magazine article, and then I wrote the article in the Reader's Digest, which I think was called Mr. Muhammad Speaks. I believe that was the title of it. And then, subsequently, I began to write for Playboy. And I began the interviews in Playboy with a piece about, as a matter of fact, Miles Davis was the first interview in Playboy. And I interviewed subsequent people, one among them, Malcolm X. And then a publisher read that interview and asked Malcolm, would he be willing to tell his life in book-length detail? Malcolm demurred about it, and finally he agreed. And then he, Malcolm, asked me if I would work with him on the book, in writing the book, because, you know, he's a very, very versatile man, but he was not a writer, and he was smart enough to know he wasn't a writer. And I say that because a number of people really think they can write something when they're not. To write is a profession like other things. Anyway, I was very excited at the opportunity. I had never written a book at the time. And Malcolm was, I had come to feel, just an electrical subject, the story of his life. He had done more in, at that time, about 36 years than the average 10 men had done. And so I then began to work with him, and it worked out that I spent 1 year interviewing him and the second year writing. And then the book was finished and was published in 1965.
Did your politics and your past were certainly very different from his.
Absolutely.
Did that trouble him? Did he want you to be to share his political views?
Not at all. You know, one of the things I always respected so much about him was he's a very smart man. And what he told me on that score was, he said, I'm not looking for a fellow Muslim. He said, I'm looking for somebody who can write. And that's, said, I have checked what you've done. He had read stuff I'd written. He said, and you can write. And I remember another of his quotes was, said, I don't want somebody who's going to be trying to interpret me. And I don't feel you will do that, that you will write, and so forth. And that's what I tried to do. And our backgrounds were very different. You know, I was and I am a Methodist, and I'm from Henning, Tennessee, and Malcolm was a Muslim, and he was from a variety of places. And his background had included, you know, what is colloquially called life in the streets and things like that, and I just simply hadn't been exposed to that. I mean, again, I grew up in a little town in the South, and then I went, you know, to school at fairly conventional black schools, and then I went into the military in the United States Coast Guard and stayed 20 years in there. So in terms of things like, you know, that Malcolm had experienced, I was as square as a block. I didn't know anything about those things, but I was a grown man. I was reasonably experienced, and I was hopefully a writer.
Did he get angry or impatient with you?
About what?
About being different from him, about not being exposed
It would sometimes amuse him when I didn't know this, that, or the other. The only time that I ever knew, you speak of Malcolm's anger, he never, to my knowledge, he got irritated at me about one thing, which I'll tell you about later, but the only time I ever saw Malcolm angry, really angry, and that was a fearsome sight to see, because he was generally very contained. He might be furious, but you'd never know it oftentimes. But the only time I ever saw him openly angry, I should say, we were in his car once, and he was driving up in Harlem. He had a blue Oldsmobile. And at this time, things had begun to get pretty tight, taut around him and his life. He was not a person, he used to say himself, upon whom anybody would do well to write an insurance policy. And so when you rode with him as his passenger, you tended to be a little light in the seat, you know. And then we were driving along, and he was doing all that rapidly, but all of a sudden he hit the brake, and the car just jolted to a stop. And before I know anything, Malcolm has flung open his door, and he's out of the car. And by the time I registered what was happening, I didn't know what on earth was a provocation for this. You know, and I think I just kind of, as far as I can remember, sort of levitated or something, trying to see what was it. I didn't know if somebody was trying to shoot him or shoot us or what. But no, it wasn't that at all. He sprang out, and there were three young men bent over on their knees shooting craps up against the door. And it happened that, it didn't register to me, but he knew it. That was the door of the County Cullen Library in Harlem, within which was the Schomburg Collection, the greatest extant collection about material about black people. And Malcolm was over these people like, I think I wrote, like an avenging angel. He was furious. And he was just grating out something like, said, inside these doors is the greatest collection in existence on black people, and other people in there studying about you and your people, and the best you can do is sit out here and shoot craps up against the door. I mean, he was just livid. And it has to be said for him that such was his personality, such was his impact, that these three young men, I'd say they were, you know, early 20s or something like that, and street guys, I would guess, they might have, I hate to think what they might have done to somebody else who dared come up on them like that. But once they recognized it was Malcolm, they almost skulked away. They just drifted away because they didn't want to tangle with Malcolm. And I never forgot that incident of his power in that community if he got angry. And I often think about that when I hear, say, younger people, younger black people today talking about, you know, this or that or the other thing about Malcolm X, the revolution, this, that, the other, that, how furious he got about the fact that these young men were not seizing an opportunity better to educate themselves about their own people or about whatever. He used to often say he wished he could start all over academically. And he used to say every night they'd have to put me out of the library when they had to close it, you know.
You spent a year interviewing him. Was he hard to interview?
You asked the perfect thing, not knowing you asked it, to get me to tell you the thing I wanted to tell you to begin with, about when I told you Malcolm got irritated at me. After the assignment had come to write about him, a book about himself, we made agreement, he and I, he would come down to my little place. I had a place at the time in Greenwich Village at 92 Grove Street in the basement. And he faithfully began to come down about three nights a week. He'd get there 9:30 or something after his busy, busy day. And I would interview him. At least that was the intent. But I would, you know, try. And then, but Malcolm was not somebody you interviewed. You tended to listen for 2 hours as he would talk. And it went on, you know, you have a kind of honeymoon period with somebody you're interviewing, and it went on, and he didn't talk about himself. All he would talk about was Mr. Muhammad, his leader, and about the Nation of Islam, his organization. And by the time he'd done that for about a month, I began to say to him, Mr. Malcolm, I know both, fine, but this book is to be about you, and we have to know something about you. And he began to get peeved and then irritated. And finally, we were in the second month, by which time I had begun to get also peeved in another direction. And I had begun to think that I really, in fairness, had to go to the publisher and say, I'm not being able to get through to him, and you may have to get somebody else to write or whatever you want to do. And that's only fair. Sometimes that happens, just chemistry. A writer and a subject may not make it together. And it wasn't we were having anything personal wrong, but the talk, he just would not talk about himself. And then this night, it was cold. The snow was knee-deep in New York. I don't know what had happened to Malcolm that day, but it was about 2 months after we had begun. And I'm uptight internally, and he's uptight. He came down that night, and he was just absolutely, again, furious. I don't know what had happened to him that day. He stalked the floor. And I remember that I knew it's like a desperate try. I've got to get this man to talk about himself. And so once again, it was maybe about 11 o'clock at night, I tried. I said, Mr. Malcolm, we've got to have something about you. And he snatched his coat up, glared at me, and started out. I remember he snatched the door open And I remember seeing how the snow had drifted up over the door jamb. You know how to do that? And why I said to him what I said, I will never know. I didn't think it. It was one of those situations, Terry, where you hear yourself saying something. You don't know where the words come. I don't know. I wouldn't have consciously asked a Malcolm X that. But I heard myself say to him, very quietly, Mr. Malcolm, could you tell me something about your mother? And I remember looking at him as almost as if he were a marionette on a string. He just kind of stopped. And I remember he closed the door, and he turned around that I can remember. I don't remember him looking directly at me, but he began to walk, and he walked more slowly than before. And I guess he made a round of the room. Before then, he spoke, and his voice was kind of higher register than he normally spoke. And he said, it's funny you should ask me that. And then he walked a little more. And then he said, I remember how she was always bent over the stove, trying to stretch what little we had. And then he walked some more. And he said, and I remember the kind of dresses she wore. They were faded and gray. And, you know, I knew it was kind of like a zombie situation. I sensed that somehow, unwittingly, I had touched a button. And that man, I tell you, Terry, he walked that floor from then, about 11:30 maybe, until the day broke. And out of him that night, that morning, spilled, tumbled. I don't think I wouldn't have asked a question. All I'm doing is taking notes as hard as I can. Out of him spilled and tumbled the essence of what is now in the first chapter of the autobiography of Malcolm X, titled appropriately, Nightmare, the story of the little boy who was about 7, in the household with his mother, with, I believe, there were a total of 7 children, and the mother was trying the best she could to hold them together, to feed them, to care for them, to just generally be the family elder for them, with the father, the minister, recently murdered, thrown under a streetcar, you know. And that was the most dramatic moment I remember. And from that point, he never hesitated to talk about any aspect of his life once that was opened.
How do you think it affected him to, in a structured way, go through his the whole past that he had that he could remember? You know, to give it to you for your book, because it's like being in therapy to go through your past in such detail. I mean, it might.
I think it probably was for him. You know, I know one thing. The thing I just now was telling you about. A few weeks after that, he told me he'd be away, and he went away for a while. I didn't ask him where. You didn't ask him where he was going. And when he came back, he was smiles, unusually so. And then he told me that he had been to Michigan, where he had gotten together with his brother, Philbert. And his brother was a minister in the Nation of Islam. And they had gone together to the institution where their mother had been for quite a long time. I don't know, was it 10, 15 years? And they had taken the first steps to have their mother released into the custody. She would be in the home of the brother, Philbert. And Malcolm was beaming. And I remember he said that he had kept blocked up in himself the memory of what he told me that night, because he just didn't want to deal with it, didn't want to face it, didn't want to think about it. But that once he had opened it, then he knew he had to go back and see his mother and help his mother and so forth. And as I say, he was quite free to talk about whatever following that. And I look back at the incident, and I could not be more certain about the fact that I had no idea when I asked him that question that it would evoke such a response. And I didn't even realize that I was asking the question, not in a conscious way. Many things, now and then, some things will happen in writing that kind of get you in you don't know where it came from, and you don't question it. It just happened.
Were you troubled by the media image of Malcolm X, the media portrayal?
Yeah, I was, in the sense that a lot of it was so slanted. it was unfair, but then that doesn't make him unique. Media has this capacity, and media certainly exercises that capacity very frequently with lots of people, you know. Most of us who become people who are, you know, what you call known or names or whatever, have some personal experience with that, and we certainly have a lot of shared experience with others who we see and we know, and we think they're dealt with unfairly. But that's the name of the game.
Well, actually, your life was told in the media when Roots became serialized on
more
TV.
More or less, yeah.
And it was, you know, really one of the most praised productions in television history, probably. Do you think that network television could now, in the mid-1980s, handle the autobiography of Malcolm X? Would you trust television with his story?
Well, I think so. I mean, it would depend. It wouldn't be television I'd worry so much about. I would concern about the writers, and I'd worry concern about the director and the producers, which really are the people behind the television, you know. There are several things which are being done about him. In fact, I met a young man here who said that I think there was an opera. I believe that they would...
There's an opera in progress that was presented in workshop form last year called X by composer Anthony Davis.
Uh-huh. Several pieces have been done about him. But there has never been, to my knowledge, a serious thrust at a television portrayal. But I think it could be done, and I think it could be done with great impact and with great taste. But again, I would certainly look to who was making it. That's right.
Mm-hmm. How did knowing Malcolm X change you? Did it?
I don't think so. Not a great deal. You know, oftentimes people ask, say, something like, how did that influence what you wrote? Or was it Malcolm X who influenced you to write Roots? And not at all. I say not at all. The only thing that I... first of all, let me say why I'm saying that. I really take what I think is rightful pride, if it be that, or whatever, in the fact that, you see, when I met Malcolm, I had been writing for a decade, magazine articles and whatnot, and moreover, I had been 20 years in the service, which would tend to suggest that I was reasonably mature, you know, in my own person. And I think that was probably pretty true. Malcolm didn't ever seem to feel that he was, you know, leading me or influencing me unduly. And I didn't either. And I'm not saying this at any cost to my relationship with Malcolm. I regarded him as I said at the outset, an electrical personality. I think that other than that, I came to regard him as the most self-disciplined man I ever knew. And I had the highest of respect for him. And I'm happy to say I think he had it in time for me. He had little ways he'd test you to find out. You know, I'll tell you one of his favorite tricks. He would say something, or he would have somebody else say something to you. And then he would have ways that he would know if you told it to somebody else. So he'd kind of wait to see were you carrying tales. And I just had a thing. It's not just about Malcolm. It's about anybody. If I am writing about them and they say something to me in a confidence, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's just that's the end of it. I will never, ever talk about it. And it's not out of any great noble whatever. It's just being fair, I think. If somebody is trusting enough of you to confide in you personal things, and almost anybody whom you interview, you know, over a period of time, there are things we would share with each other that might be relative trivia, but it wouldn't be something for somebody to know, you know. And I'll give you a case in point. Just recently, I was talking at length with a native Philadelphian of whom I think Philadelphia ought to be very, very proud, is Bill Cosby. And I was doing an article about Bill for a magazine, the latest home journal. And we were recording what we talked about. Now, in the course of a long conversation, here or there, you know, the name of somebody would come up, some person who's out there today as a performer or something, And he would say something, I would say something, something we just personally happen to know. There is no way I would ever reveal that stuff out because it's of no moment, really. But it's the kind of stuff that somebody could twist and say, Cosby said, or I said, or he and I both said something negative about somebody out there, and neither of us would think of doing that. And I think that's fair, you know. I forgot what you asked me. I got to going off on something else. What did you ask me?
Well, let me see. Where
you forgot, too.
Well, I can't remember exactly what the question was, but we only have a couple of minutes left, and I know what I want to ask you before we end. I think common knowledge, because it's been written about in several articles about you, that when you first got out of the Coast Guard and you started to try to publish, that you got a bunch of rejection notices from magazines that you papered your walls with.
I did. I had papered them before I got out of the Coast Guard.
Realize you were approaching.
No, you see, I wrote 8 years in the Coast Guard before I sold. So I was selling when I got out.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure now that you have become a kind of model for a lot of people who are trying to break into writing. Now, you can look at that two ways. I mean, someone can say, well, look at a writer like Alex Haley. You know, he got all these rejection notices, and then he wrote two incredibly praised books that, you know, are still in print after years and so on. But on the other hand, that encouragement could be encouraging people who aren't good writers and who are getting rejection notices because they're not good writers and they probably won't become good writers. How do you think about that, about the example
that
that
says? Well, I think the thing is that of course there are people who won't make it, but the point is what you're addressing yourself to is the people who will make it if they keep it going. And, you know, you talk about being models. I know you are somebody's model. You probably a lot of people. I just happen to know one I heard about Reverend and Mrs. Leon Sullivan's daughter, Julie, is getting a master's degree now in journalism, and you are her model. She said she likes to do interviews on your way, in your style.
So you too.
Well, that's all right. It's the truth. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, when we talk these kinds of things about advice we might give to people who are on their way in the same career area, always you're pitching to the people who are trying. And the people who ultimately will make it. There's nothing that guarantees success to anybody in any field, except you keep trying. You refuse to quit.
Have you ever had the feeling like, I wish I could see one of those editors, now that I have a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize, meet one of those editors who rejected me back in the old days?
I do meet them. I know, indeed so. And now, you know what, we hug each other. You know, I've had a lot of things happening where, you know, it was like, aha, see? But I never feel vengeful. I never feel, wow, you buster, I got you now. Rather, you just hug them. And I mean hug them sincerely because, you see, Terry, the thing is, rejection slips, they're not, you shouldn't take them personally. A rejection slip simply says you have not quite done yet what we want to do. And another thing I would certainly like to share with people who think about writing, and I've come to know this now with exposure now to editors and publishers, who now take me out to buy me big dinners. The shrimp look like lobsters. Yes, they do. But the thing I've come to know now is that editors and publishers are looking just as hard for that exciting new writer as any writer is looking to get published. And that's the truth.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And I look forward to the publication of your new book, which is scheduled for September?
September.
Who's the publisher going to be?
Doubleday.
Okay. And that book is titled Henning, and it's about Alex Haley's childhood in Henning, Tennessee. And as you know, he's also the author of Roots and the author of the autobiography of Malcolm X. What brings him to Philadelphia today is a benefit this evening for the Philadelphia Miniversity, which is a community-based educational program, and he will be speaking at a benefit dinner this evening, so I'll give you a phone number if you'd like to call for more information. The number is 765-2815. That's 765-2815. And again, thank you very much
for talking with us. My pleasure.
The time now is 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. You might have heard that John Sayles was going to be with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. Well, we had to reschedule that interview for another day. So filmmaker John Sayles will be with us live on Fresh Air Tuesday afternoon at about 3:45, and also be with us will be actress Maggie Renzi, who has co-produced several of Sayles' films with him. So that's this Tuesday at 3:45, and perhaps on Monday we'll hear Sayles read one of his own short stories from a program of his work. Well, earlier today in Washington, D.C., General William Westmoreland addressed the National Press Club. We're going to hear his address and the question and answer period which followed, tape delayed from National Public Radio.
Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, and Dial Magazine, providing program information to subscribers of participating public broadcasting stations nationwide. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., this is another in the continuing series of programs from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stasio. Today's guest speaker is retired General William Westmoreland.
Have your attention, please. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is David Hess. I'm with Knight Ridder Newspapers. I'm president of the club. We have a special event today to celebrate the Freedom of Information Law. It's a joint meeting of the Society of Professional Journalists with the Press Club. Peter Pritchard, who is chairman of the Society's Freedom of Information Committee, and who is Associate Editorial Director of USA Today, will be our moderator. And Peter, now I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you, David. The Society deeply appreciates your generous help and cooperation in allowing us to have this joint meeting with you today to celebrate Freedom of Information Day. The purpose of this event is to celebrate Freedom of Information Day, which is James Madison's birthday, tomorrow, March 16th. But some people have asked, including some well-known colleagues of mine in the Society of Professional Journalists, why in the world did you invite General Westmoreland to speak on Freedom of Information Day? And I'd just like to answer that question and get it out of the way so I don't have to deal with it here on the cards afterwards, although I'll be glad to. Certainly, we could have invited a respected journalist to be with us today to extol the virtues of a free press, and unfettered information for everyone. That would have been the easy thing to do, and it would have been satisfying to many of us. After all, those of us who have been converted always enjoy listening to preachers of our own persuasion. And I'm sure none of our members would have been surprised, and I'm sure I wouldn't have heard any complaints. But we decided to do something different. General Westmoreland is...